It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A challenge to Wisconsin's abortion ban could already be making its way to the state Supreme Court. The 1849 law went back into effect last June when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. The WPR series, How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849, explores how the ban came to be and how Wisconsinites have lived with and without it since. In part two of our series, WPR's Hope Kerwin looked into how the ban was enforced. She spoke with All Things Considered host Brady Carlson.
Hope, in practice, how total was this near-total abortion ban?
It's clear that abortions continue to take place across the state after the ban was put in place. We don't have complete figures, but historians say there's a lot of evidence of this. And even the state medical society, which had backed the ban, acknowledged that illegal abortion was still happening regularly.
Then how common was it for prosecutors to bring charges against someone under this law?
Not very common, as far as we can tell. A researcher who surveyed available county court records from 1849 to 1900 found only 17 cases during those 50 years. And of those 17, only 5 were found guilty. We talked to Marquette University law professor Lisa Mazie. She said undoubtedly people were still having abortions. They just weren't being prosecuted for them.
That procedure is sort of inherently a very private, personal one, right? And so in order to find out that it has happened, you need people to tell you, to tell law enforcement.
So as long as no one admitted being involved in the abortion, or as it was often called in the newspapers then, an illegal operation, then police and prosecutors wouldn't have evidence that an abortion had taken place.
And without that evidence, they couldn't prosecute. But there was an effort to increase enforcement of abortion bans starting in the mid-20th century, partly because surgical abortions were becoming more popular. But Lauren McIver-Thompson told us it was also part of a broader focus on enforcing anti-obscenity laws. She is a history professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia who studies birth control and abortion in the 20th century.
They're lumping in illegal abortion alongside all kinds of illicit sex, whether it's, you know, same-sex sex or heterosexual sex outside of marriage.
But even during that push to enforce the law, they would have had to find some proof that the law had been broken, correct?
Yes. And what usually prompts officials to bring charges under the abortion ban is the death of someone who's pregnant. Let's look at the case of Hazel Williamson from Wanakee. In 1943, Williamson traveled to Milwaukee with a list of 3 doctors her fiancé had given her. The 34-year-old was a farmer's daughter, an active member of the Wanakee Women's Club, and one of many women working in a factory during World War II. She was also 2 to 5 months pregnant. She chose the first name on her list, Dr. Edmund Tim.
And we'll come back to that list in a moment, but what happens when she goes to Dr. Tim?
Tim sent Williamson to what was called a lying-in home, used by people seeking an abortion. Reports say at least 5 abortion patients were staying at this house when Williamson was there. Williamson returned to Tim's office for an operation. A witness later testified she said Tim was, quote, like a horse doctor, and that the operation hurt her. That evening, she started running a fever. 2 days later, Tim performed a second procedure on Williamson. Early the next morning, she died from sepsis and a uterine hemorrhage.
So the authorities would have taken Dr. Tim's treatment of Williamson as evidence that he was responsible for her death and the death of the fetus.
Plus, Tim arrived at the lying-in home shortly after Williamson's death. And before he called the coroner, he went through her purse to find that list of doctors and ripped his name off the top. But Tim was still charged with second-degree manslaughter under the state's abortion law.
And ultimately, he was found guilty. So this case highlights that people knew where to get an abortion, and in large cities like Milwaukee, there was an industry, even if it was small and underground, that was supporting abortion procedures.
Right. Williamson's procedure was clearly botched, but McIver-Thompson says it was probably unusual at the time.
We do start seeing more surgical abortions being performed in the early 20th century than we did in the 19th century, just as kind of medical advancements in surgery are made, things become a little bit safer. And in fact, by the 1930s, surgical abortion is actually pretty safe.
Were doctors and other practitioners the only ones charged under the law?
That mostly appears to be the case. But there was a prosecution in 1933 of a 28-year-old Madison woman named Lily Cordio. Cordia was charged with performing an illegal operation on 25-year-old Elizabeth Rip. Rip was the girlfriend of Cordia's younger brother and was hospitalized after a miscarriage. Police questioned her just hours before she died, and that's when she implicated Cordia. Cordia admitted that she told Rip how to end a pregnancy, but she was adamant that she wasn't directly involved and told Rip it was dangerous. She said Rip came to her house, went into her bathroom, and a few minutes later came out and announced that she had done it. McIver Thompson says this scenario is not surprising.
That was a knowledge that was shared by women passed down at the kitchen table, you know, over cups of coffee. You know, you would share what methods had worked.
Was there evidence Cordia may have performed the abortion?
Police did find medical instruments in Cordia's home, but McIver Thompson says you could order dilation instruments and vaginal probes from the Sears catalog or any drugstore.
On the one hand, yes, those things can be used to perform an abortion on yourself, but they also were used for other reasons, you know, women seeking to treat themselves at home for vaginal and uterine problems.
Cordia initially faced three charges: secondary manslaughter for Rip's death, performing an illegal operation, and advising Rip on how to perform the abortion. Only the last charge, which was brought under the state's morality laws, makes it to trial. In the end, Cordia is found guilty and is sentenced to 6 months in county jail.
Let's talk a little bit more about the morality laws that you mentioned in talking about a case of an unmarried Racine woman in 1922.
Anna Young obtained an abortion when she was between 6 and 8 weeks pregnant and was hospitalized after the procedure. Young lived, but police found out about her case, and that led to the arrest of Dr. A. M. Foster. Foster claimed he did not perform an abortion, but a jury found him guilty. But then Foster sued the state. He claimed that even if he had performed the abortion, he shouldn't be convicted under the state's abortion ban. He argued the state's morality laws applied to his case because Young's pregnancy was so early on.
There are these statutes related to abortion that the legislature created in 1858, cataloged under offenses against chastity, morality, and decency. One of them made it illegal to help a woman procure a miscarriage.
And the state Supreme Court ended up agreeing with Foster. Quote, a 2 months embryo is not a human being in the eye of the law, and therefore its destruction constitutes an offense against morality and not against lives and persons. Lisa Mazey told us the court essentially assumes the morality laws were created to cover situations that involved a fetus that wasn't yet a person.
The court tries to make sense of legislative enactments, right? And they're trying to think there had to be a logical reason they did what they did.
This interpretation stood until the 1950s, that abortions in early pregnancy are covered by the morality laws. In 1955, the state legislature eliminated the morality laws and clarified that an unborn child, quote, meant a human being from the time of conception. That meant anyone who terminated a pregnancy at any stage could be arrested and charged under the abortion ban.
That was WPR's Hope Kerwin speaking with Brady Carlson for our series, How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 20,000 students across Wisconsin participate in the National FFA organization. At the Brown County Fair, the Bayport High School chapter is hosting an event to teach students with special needs how to raise and show a pig. WPR producer Courtney Everett recently spoke with two members of the chapter, reporter Nadia Herrig and Vice President Megan Roschlow.
Megan, you are one of more than 150 students involved in Future Farmers of America at Bayport High School. What are you learning through the program?
We're learning a little bit about everything, about agriculture and even more. We're learning about the natural environment side of it, and we're also learning about the animals and the reproductive side of it. So we just learn a little bit of everything.
Megan, what do you like best?
I'm more of like the animal and reproductive side, as I show livestock, and I'm also part of that. But even based off that, we learn about leadership, careers, everything like that.
Nadia, how does the Future Farmers of America support the Green Bay community?
We do many different community events. We have cleaned up local cemeteries in the past. We do events with our local schools where we bring in students from the elementary schools and teach them a bit about what we do up here at the high school and how to do different things in agriculture. We did an egg camp this past year where they got to learn about things on the farm, things in the kitchen, in the greenhouse, and even outdoors. We did a little bit of a hunter safety type of thing. And yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That sounds like so much fun. And Nadia, the Bayport FFA has a new event at this year's Brown County Fair. Tell us about the special drive pig show.
So this year at the Brown County Fair on August 18th at 3 p.m., we are starting our first ever special drive where we are going to get our livestock exhibitors, specifically swine showmen, and then we'll partner them up with another showman from the Brown County, and then they will teach a student who may have special needs together how to raise and show a pig. So they'll go through all the steps of the basic care of the pig, grooming them, feeding them, and then they'll get to learn how to show a pig and then have the opportunity to do so in the end.
That's amazing. Nadia, how did this special drive even come to be?
Well, it all started me and Megan and the rest of our officer team were at our summer retreat last summer, and we wanted to bring this event to the Brown County Fair last summer, but we did not have enough time to plan it through, but we were fortunately able to do it now, and we wanted to be able to bring something that we're passionate about and teach it to others in the community, so we thought that this would be a great way to do so.
Megan, talk to me about your role in the event and why it's important to you to bring something like this to the community.
So my role in the event, same as Nadia's, were we set up everything. We contacted sponsors. We got the barn reserved. We talked to the fair board to make sure that this was okay. We sent out waivers. We made a presentation. We did a lot of stuff for this. So then during the event, we're going to run the mentor meeting, and we're just going to be walking around, double checking on everything. And I think this is really important because it gets the livestock industry out into the world, and it gets special needs students and livestock exhibitors the opportunities that they never had before.
Let me reintroduce you. We're talking about an effort to connect kids with farm life. Our guests are high school juniors Megan Roshlow and Nadia Herrig. Both are members of Bayport Future Farmers of America. Megan, my understanding is up to 15 students plan to then partner with Brown County exhibitors. You're learning to raise pigs and show pigs. What does showing a pig at the fair involve for those people that have no idea what showing a pig entails?
First, it really involves the beginning of a show day is just getting it washed and prepared, which that can be anywhere from 5 minutes to 15 minutes, depending if they think it's a good choice to roll around in the mud and get all dirty again. So you really got some patience with that. And then you go into feeding them. So you get them as big as you want and they get to learn about how they got there. A big part of it, which all showmen know, is the walking and getting them in the show ring, which I think that is probably one of our biggest lessons that we're going to be showing the special needs students in this. So they're going to have some practice time before they get in the ring and they'll get to learn about that.
Megan, elaborate a little bit more on that, the showing inside the ring. Give me a visual of, these students with special needs that come in or showing animals and they might be in wheelchairs.
So people in wheelchairs, we're obviously going to have someone helping them through there, helping them in the ring, but we're going to open them up to a harness also, that with the pig. We're still testing that out. We're going to see if that works or not, but we're going to do that to make it more available for them. And if they feel comfortable without the harness, we're also going to step back and observe and make sure that everything's good. So then they can use the stereotypical whip or whatever guiding tool that people use in the show ring.
And what do you mean by harness?
Kind of like a dog. If you've ever seen a dog on a collar, kind of goes over its shoulders. We're going to try to test it out with the pigs, even though these pigs that are in these harnesses are probably 50 pounds and we're dealing with 230 plus. So we're going to try to make it work.
That sounds great. Nadia, I know you've helped Wisconsin students with special needs show animals from their wheelchairs. You were involved in a program in Fond du Lac shadowing students. Tell me about that experience. What was it like for you?
Yeah, so last summer I had the opportunity to go down to the Fond du Lac County Fair and assist them in their special drive that they put on every year. They've been hosting this event for quite some time, so they kind of knew what they were doing. And I went to go take a look and see what it would be like if we brought it to our county. And so I was actually partnered with a group of two students with special needs who are both in wheelchairs. So me and the other student from our chapter who went down there with me, Griffin Gerke, we were kind of in charge of, we were able to push them in their wheelchairs throughout the whole event. We assisted the people who were from that county who were doing the actual teaching of the lesson, and we got to have an inside look of what they do with their pigs. And then, unfortunately, the actual swine show part of the event was stormed out due to tornado warnings. So
that, oh, no.
Yeah.
Nadia, what was it like seeing the reaction of the kids you were helping?
It was awesome. Like, I don't even have words of how to explain. It was really cool to see them be able to do something that I'm so passionate about and love, and seeing others enjoy is really great to see. They had a lot of fun being able to scrub the pig down, feed them, and the excitement on their faces was amazing.
Megan, what do you hope participating students learn from showing pigs at the Brown County Fair?
I hope they learn a lot about the livestock industry, as this is a very important industry in Wisconsin and even all throughout the world. And I also hope they learn that they can do whatever we can do and everyone can help each other, because this is a great opportunity no matter what.
Nadia, how about you? How do you feel?
I agree with Megan. I think it's going to be a great opportunity for these kids and our livestock exhibitors. I hope that it touches their heart more to be able to help these kids, and these kids being able to come and hang out with us, have a good time, do things with other kids their age. We're going to have a dinner there provided as well from the 4-H bar. We're going to have milkshakes, and then Scott Subs is providing us with subs to eat.
That sounds delicious. Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was WPR producer Courtney Everett speaking with Bayport FFA members Nadia Herrig and Megan Roschlow. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get tips now for handling insurance claim denials and what to know about the appeals process. Call in with questions about your disputed claims, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sachin Gupte is an attorney and clinical assistant professor at UW Law School's Center for Patient Partnerships. Sachin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Good morning. Let's start from the beginning. What is the first thing a patient should do after their claim is denied?
Read the denial and be clear about the reason why a claim was denied. There's usually three reasons that we see. One is that it's simply not a covered benefit. A second reason that we see is that it's not medically necessary. And the third reason that we typically see is that the procedure is experimental or investigational.
So basically, the first thing to do is reach out and make sure you understand what the denial is in the first place?
Correct.
And so after that step, you have clarity. The claim is still denied. What do you do next?
So you're going to want to look at your actual insurance policy, and that can be sometimes a little tricky to actually get a hold of. Some insurance companies make it very accessible. It might be on an online portal, but other times that you kind of get the runaround in seeing what the actual policy is. They'll send you a summary of benefits sometimes, which is a short 5 to 10 page pamphlet that kind of outlines it. But what you really want to look at is the contract. And so those are usually anywhere from like 80 to 100 pages, and that's just all words, and it kind of lays out what is covered, when it's covered, the criteria, and that's really what we're looking to enforce when we do insurance denials, and included in that policy is deadlines, and so those are going to be incredibly important in terms of how much time do you have to dispute that claim.
What is the time frame? What is typical for how long you have?
So it's going to depend a little bit on what type of insurance you have. So if you have public insurance, Medicaid rules are going to be a little bit different. Medicare rules are going to be a little bit different. But if you have fully insured insurance, typically that's going to be at least 60 days. Usually they give you up to 180, but it's going to be at least 60. Medicaid gives you 45 days to dispute a claim, and I believe Medicare is going to be 120 days.
Where will be the sticking points in that time frame? What will take longer?
The longest thing is sometimes just getting all the documents that you need to be able to answer to the reason of the denial. So one of the things that is incredibly important is the relationship that you have with your provider, especially if the reason the insurance company is saying that it's not going to be covered is that it's not medically necessary. Your best advocate a lot of times is going to be your provider, and they can either write a letter of support, they can even reach out, talk to the medical director at the insurance company and kind of streamline that process. But getting all those things in order is sometimes the most time consuming part of insurance appeals.
And what is the most effective way to communicate with that primary care physician and insurance companies during this appeal process?
You can use MyChart to initiate and kind of talk to your provider about like, hey, this is the response that I've got. Usually they're already clued in. Some providers are very proactive and they can do a peer-to-peer review with the insurance company. Some providers are unfamiliar with that process, but you can talk to their staff, kind of understand their reasoning. And so that's something that our clinic does quite a bit of. We'll have our clients sign releases. We'll talk to the provider and their staff about like, okay, why are they recommending this particular treatment? Standard of treatment says this, why is this not applicable? And we put that into a letter form and submit it for our clients.
So these peer-to-peer conversations are between a patient's provider and their medical insurance company. How can patients ensure that that process goes as smoothly as possible?
So that's a lot on, to be honest with you, that's going to be a lot on the provider itself. And the patient's not going to be included in that conversation. And so understanding the urgency is something that the patient will have to have that conversation with the provider about like, hey, like there is a timeline here that I'm trying to follow for various reasons, whether it's medical or life, and being like, I only have 3-month window to get this procedure done. I really need this done. Can you get on the phone with the medical director? And so you are a bit reliant on your provider and for the peer-to-peer review, excuse me.
Do you have any tips on the best ways to document each interaction, each thing that happens in the appeal process for, you know, as a patient?
Yeah, the first thing that I recommend doing is just putting together a timeline, both of who you spoke to, when you spoke to them, names, both on the clinic side and also on the insurance side. Even if it's informal communications, I think one thing that is always effective is if you can make an argument that as a patient, you did your due diligence and you did all the things that the insurance company asked of you. And if somebody on the insurance side said, gave you the thumbs up and said like, yep, everything's good to go, while that's not going to necessarily be conclusive, it really helps to make an effective argument of like, hey, like we relied on this information. It's in the contract that should be covered. We spoke to so-and-so on this date at this time, and they said everything looks good. So why am I being stuck with this bill now?
Talking about rejected health insurance claims, the anatomy of an appeal, if you will. Sachin Gupte here, UW-Madison Law School professor. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Norman in De Pere is here. Norman, hi. Go ahead.
I'm a retired medical director, family physician. So I had personally denied many claims and reviewed them over time. And thought we had a very fair appeal process. We would send it out for external review by physicians of the appropriate specialist. But several years ago, I found myself on the other end of a denial of an MRI that was used for diagnosis of my prostate cancer. I went through 3 levels of appeal, including a administrative law judge. And the final result was that you make some very excellent points on why it should be covered, but it's still denied because that was the Medicare policy. So, but on the other side, there are many claims that are unnecessary and are appropriately denied. And I still had the MRI. I just had to pay for it out of pocket. So
what does it make you think about the system, and where do you see solutions?
Well, what really troubled me is I tried to speak to the medical director of the insurance company, and basically refused to accept my calls, which was, as a medical director previously, I had always, if a physician would call, would at least discuss the case with them. They didn't agree with the decisions necessarily, but at least it helped to get additional information. But I still think it's a worthwhile system, and I just would say if you feel strongly about a denied claim, follow through the appeals process.
Norman, really appreciate you bringing your story illuminating here. Sachin, go ahead.
Yeah, I would echo a lot of what Norman just said. A lot of insurance appeals is about perseverance. The first level of appeal is going to be at the internal level. And understandably, you don't see the most success at that level because insurance companies are kind of overseeing themselves and policing themselves in terms of the denial of the claim. We often see the most success at the external level where we have a more objective review process, but it takes time and diligence to get there because there will be sometimes multiple levels of internal appeal that you have to exhaust before you can get to that external review.
I wonder what types of cases typically do you and your students take on at your Center for Patient Partnerships? What do you look for?
So we kind of see everything across the spectrum. Sometimes it's going out of network to get a second opinion because there's a certain specialist that has an expertise that you're looking to see. Sometimes it's when somebody hasn't responded to standard treatment for cancer and the doctor wants to prescribe something that might be considered experimental, but there's valid reason, medical reasons why they think it'll be successful. Sometimes it's after the fact that treatment's already been given and everything went great, but for whatever reason, I think you kind of touched upon this in the previous segment, is that maybe the codes just don't add up and the insurance company just flat out denies it and patients kind of just stuck questioning kind of why is this on my lap now?
How successful is your center, in closing these cases successfully for the patient?
I can say that we've had quite a bit of success. There's never a guarantee, but one of the things I think that makes us successful is the students are able to kind of pay attention to the details that when you're sick and you have a lot on your shoulders, you may not have the time and patience to go through that process.
Let's go to Kenneth now in Stoughton. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. I would like to question the likelihood of actually being able to reach someone to resolve a problem. My wife and I are both old enough to be on Medicare. We're in our 70s. She had an x-ray done and read that she had breast cancer and a lumpectomy. So as part of that follow-up, there were an x-ray taken, and for whatever reason, it was done by a company or a service in Madison, Wisconsin. We got a notice that was being turned over for bill collection for not being paid, and the tracking it down, it turned out that they have it read by another company or association of some sort, and the billing came out of a company out of Texas, and so we could never, ever get a hold of anybody to talk to who could resolve it. They just kept saying it's been turned over to corrections. It was just impossible to reach a real person.
Kenneth, thank you. Just really understanding this maze and communication not being able to get through. Can this story something that you hear, Sachin?
Yeah, unfortunately, it is something that we hear pretty common. One thing that hospitals traditionally have done is sell their unpaid bills to collection agencies. More recently, sometimes they hire collection agencies to do the collection on their behalf, which can be a little bit tricky because you don't know who you actually owe money to. And so that's something that we try and disentangle for a lot of our clients.
How should patients respond if the hospitals or the insurers have sent, threatening letters or a patient's unpaid medical bills to debt collectors?
The first thing that I recommend is responding to that debt collector. The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is very effective in terms of understanding the status of somebody's debt. And so you can ask the debt collector to validate or authenticate the debt. And that basically is asking them to prove that they actually are the owners of that debt. And if they're not able to show that, that kind of tips their hand that if they were to file in court, that they probably don't have any evidence to show that they are actually entitled to collect money from you.
Attorney Sachin Gupte is Legal Advocacy Coordinator at the UW Center for Patient Partnerships. Call in with questions, your tips on where to start if insurance has denied your medical claim, your story in the appeals process, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show and the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Millions of medical claims are denied each year. We learn the best defense for how to navigate an appeal and communicate with a health insurance company and your doctor. Call in with questions. Call in with your stories, your lessons learned in these appeals. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Attorney Sachin Gupte works on providing health and legal advocacy in the Center for Patient Partnerships at UW-Madison. Stays with us. Sachin, we heard from Diane in Waterloo, called and said that they have been dealing with insurance companies for 24 years now because of their child. And Diane learned over the years that if a person is in a drug trial, regardless if it is out of network or out of state, insurance companies must cover it. Diane says it is Wisconsin law. And I'm wondering, can you speak to protections like these?
Yeah, they're going to be kind of very specific to what the trial is about, but we have had some cases where our clients were enrolled in clinical trials, but then still got stuck with a bill. And so there are protections in place. And I think you have to be very clear with kind of the clinic coordinator on the trial side to be to have some clarity in terms of what's going to be covered by the trial itself. And then what can be billed towards insurance if things are considered standard treatment or standard of care, and I'm talking about labs that would be run anyway, insurance companies would be required to cover that. And then whatever the trial drug is would also be covered by the investigation side.
So certainly paying attention to the contract in the trial itself, and then making sure that there's clarity with the insurance company as well, because you need to know what matches up with what your insurance is covering.
Correct.
And there are two different types of health insurance appeals, internal and external appeals. Can you tell us what sets the two apart?
Yeah, it is going to be who is actually doing the review. So when we talk about an internal review, it is the insurance company themselves who are reviewing the claim and the denial. And their process is usually made up of their own employees. They don't necessarily have any expertise in on the medical side, which can be good or bad, but it could be somebody who is in their HR department, in their accounting department, and they kind of come together as a committee and review the denied claim. And we can submit things beforehand to articulate why we think something should be covered from a medical standpoint.
Typically, with these medical directors inside insurance companies looking at case by case, what type of physicians are they?
They can be across the board. I think family medicine is the one specialty that we see most often because they deal with the most variety. And so that is the most common specialist that we've come across.
How does someone know which type of appeal is right for their situation, or understanding who is looking at the appeal?
Yeah, that can be incredibly confusing in terms of where you are in the process or where you should appeal. That goes back to that original contract. And so when I was talking earlier about the insurance policy, that is the 80 to 100-page contract, that will outline kind of what your appeal rights are, how you submit it, when you can submit it. And that should also be included in the denial letter that patients receive. And so whether that's in the mail or electronic, it should outline what an individual's appeals rights are.
Paul from La Crosse wants to know, if insurance companies are denying claims like this, is it better for people to forego insurance, hope they don't get sick, and pay for medical bills out of pocket?
That will get very expensive. The bills don't go away. And so if you're able to pay out of pocket, like, that is an option. But I think the average person, those bills would rack up pretty quickly, especially when you get sick. And so I do encourage people to push back on insurance companies and go through the appeal process.
Okay. Let's go to Gary now in La Crosse. Gary, what is your story?
I had my insurance go up in February, so I called to make sure I paid the proper amount and talked to their customer service. They quoted me an amount. I paid it, but they underquoted me, so they canceled my insurance. And then I called again in March to straighten it out, and they wouldn't let me pay the difference, and they canceled my insurance, and now I've lost all my coverage and my medication coverage, and it'll take 6 to 8 weeks to straighten it out.
Sachin, do you have any tips or suggestions with Gary's story here?
Yeah, that's incredibly frustrating. I would recommend starting with, if you have notes in terms of who you spoke to when you got the quote, what they sent you, and if you feel like you paid in full, ultimately that is a review that could be seen by the officer of commissioner insurance. And if they felt, and if they, upon the review, feel like, no, this is a valid contract and you upheld your side of it, your coverage could be reinstated. That obviously doesn't help in the interim when you don't have medication, but that is one option to pursue.
Gary, I know this is extremely personal, but to ask you, if your medications aren't covered right now, how much are you forking over to continue on them?
They offered to let me pay for my insurance and fill out a form to get reimbursed if and when it gets settled. You know, they've admitted their guilt, like I said, but the time frame it's going to take to get it to go through, I mean, the insurance, the medications are in the thousands a month.
Wow. Sachin, you know, such a predicament here. This is must be very distressing.
Yeah, the other thing that I would consider is reaching out to the manufacturer of some of these drugs. We've had some success as a center in the past reaching out directly and explaining the situations and the need. And they oftentimes are willing or have programs to help people pay for drugs when they're too expensive, or in situations like this where they know they will be getting paid eventually. That sometimes is an option to alleviate the short-term burden.
What Wisconsin organizations can help with the medical appeals process?
So in addition to us at the Center for Patient Partnerships, there is Legal Action can take on some Medicaid cases, I believe. There's also Disability Rights. They, I think, specialize more on the Medicare side of things. There's also, in terms of getting connected, I don't think they do as much with appeals, but Covering Wisconsin is a great resource in terms of getting connected to care.
If a patient is eligible for medical debt forgiveness, should they take that option and forego appeals?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Well, if they, you know, are eligible for medical debt forgiveness and they're in the throes of different appeals, what option should they take? What road would you suggest?
Yeah, I would say if a hospital is offering to write off a bill, and a lot of them will have something that they refer to as charity care, if people are eligible, if they're low income, or if they fall under a certain grant, if a hospital is willing to kind of waive the bill, then I would absolutely jump on that opportunity.
Sachin, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sachin Gupte is an attorney and clinical assistant professor at UW Law School's Center for Patient Partnerships. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.